the Imprecise Storytelling Series, presented by Zooming in the Lens podcast with Olivia May, that's me, and my teacher, Katrina Chester. This series will be impromptu conversations that have arrived between Katrina and I. I've been in practice with her for a few years now, and we've also been blessed to share roles as employee and boss, friends, and most importantly, student to student. We offer these talks not to be right or wrong, not to be good or bad. Instead, to be present and amazed at how many ways to shift perceptions that lead to a deeper awareness of ourselves and others. I, for one, have been greatly affected by these kinds of conversations with Katrina, and I'm excited to share a day in the life of me at work, which is all practice. Imprecise storytelling is a metaphor. We all think we know who we are, and then we share who we are with those around us. But what if we are more or less? What if beliefs cloud what is? What if they stop the curiosity to explore? Just imagine if in doing that, we are our own imprecise storytellers. Hey, I'll take off my judgment hat if you take off yours.
I want to say something about the subtle inroads fear can make in your lives. If you no longer allow fear to step blatantly before you and shout a cataclysm, it will creep behind you and whisper something reasonable in your ear. Beware of reasonable, rational thinking, reasonable supposition. Doubt is the rabbit's foot of fear. Ask your higher wisdom if it is not true that without worry, you would have arrived exactly where you are now, and more pleasantly. Worry and fear are not tickets on the express train. They are extra baggage. You were going that way anyway.
Hi guys, it's Olivia and Katrina here.
Hello.
We are enjoying a lovely afternoon here in sunny California, and we're about to have a wonderful imprecise storytelling.
On what?
On fear.
Oh, way to give me advance notice on fear.
Katrina's feeling fear right now because she
I'm about to talk about fear. Oh, boy.
She hasn't had as much time as she prefers.
Oh, what's that, like a week and a half or something?
To prep.
Yeah.
Today's brought to you by Chai Teas and Palo Santo.
Oh, yes. A friend of mine went overseas and did some traveling and brought me back a stick of Palo Santo, which has to grow on the ground, I am told, for 9 years. Has to fall off the tree, sit on the ground for 9 years, and then you can burn it. It's a beautiful stick of incense that's used in all sorts of rituals and ceremonies, but I love the smell. And ironically, this was somebody that when she first started practicing with me, she hated the smell.
Oh,
and she would come in and go, I can't stand this smell. And I'd say, interesting.
Oh, that reminds me of when I was young and my dad would just make us drive out into the sort of countries of like outside of Fresno and Clovis, kind of going up into some hills. And the smell, he just was like, smell that, guys, smell this fresh air. And I was just so like, oh, it was making me nauseous and I disliked it. But I smell the exact same smell when I run around Balboa Lake.
Wow.
And it brings me back to how much I've grown into the enjoying that. And I didn't then with my dad, but I enjoy it.
Well, that's interesting because that's, you know, really the response system of the memories in our brain. We make all these associations to smells and things we see, and then all of a sudden, bam, whatever that triggers, I guess like fear, we think it's happening in the now, but it's actually already happened to us.
Yeah. I have a recent thing that happened, which brought a lot of fear. And it's not even like fear now, it's future fear. Like I'm feeling fear right now for the future. So Adam, my boyfriend's brother is out of town for 3 weeks on National Guard. And so his wife, you know, they have two kids. His wife got immediately sick. So she's been in the hospital for a few days. And we got called to go pick up the kids. And we don't have a car seat. We had to get one from the grandparents. And we get the car seat. And we're trying to put the car seat in the back. And we don't have kids. We've never put in a car seat in a car. And reading it to instructions for putting this car seat in, I just had none of it. Adam was all about it. I couldn't even read it. It was a different language. And I just said to him, I already feel like a horrible parent. I already feel like I'm going to be a horrible parent because right now I can't figure out how to put a car seat in.
And so that told you that that is how you would parent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? And you said that too. And how you started that was by saying, I'm fearing something that is in the future. Yeah. Like, that really is all we can do is feel future and past. I mean, if you're feeling present fear, then feel it because it's presently happening. So that brings us to, like, I mean, so many different levels of what fear is. Fear can be felt in the present, right?
Yeah.
I have absolutely. I was mugged in San Francisco, and I felt fear at that present time. But if I had felt fear about being mugged prior to being mugged, when it didn't happen, it definitely didn't help me.
Right.
But we think that it does.
Right, that makes me think if you felt fear prior to being mugged, you would have done something different.
Right.
To not get mugged.
But I did feel fear prior to getting mugged. And I worried about it. I never thought it would happen in San Francisco. I'm from New York. I was never mugged in New York, ironically. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, I'm definitely fearful of that. I think if anybody thinks about it, they wouldn't want that to happen. But fear is different because fear is generating a lot of different biochemicals. When I got mugged, I did the exact opposite of what I had been preaching and saying that I know I would do if I ever got mugged. I completely froze. And here I was, you know, all these years earlier saying, kick anybody's ass who tries to touch me and blah, 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 and, you know. And that's not at all what happened. Now, instead of it being a feeling of hopelessness, where I go, well, you know, now I'm fearful that I have no idea what would happen to me ever because my mind is not telling me the truth. And then I have all this sort of, I wallow in this self-doubt, which has happened to me. You know, through understanding a little bit about how the mind and how the brain works, a spiritual understanding, and investigating through like a psychological lens type of thing, I can see that it gives me hope that I didn't respond exactly the way I thought I would. Because that means that I don't know everything and that anything is possible. Anything is possible. The hard part is finding our way out of that. How to doubt ourselves without becoming insecure about anything we do and remaining in this state of non-action. Anyway, whatever. I don't know why I went off on that.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you thinking about in doing a podcast, an episode about fear?
I think it came from last week having sort of, you know, every month I have sort of my shift where I feel the exact opposite for an X amount of time than I did days before or the days to come. And it sent me into sort of, it sends me into, you know, a negative, like, area of my brain where I just sit in that for a while, and everything's just really fear-based. Decisions, I've come to really realize I just can't make any decisions during this time because none of it's my real brain right now. It's not really what I want to make decisions from and all that. And interesting about this time is it's usually longer or shorter, but I had very specific 2 days of this time where I just couldn't handle anything. And I had, you know, when events happen to me during that time, they just are absolutely larger and make everything feel like a big black hole. I fear that I'll never get out of this. I'm stuck in it. And it's true, I'm stuck in it during that time, but this time I was certainly more aware of it than I have been in the past because I feel like I keep getting better and better every month when this happens with being awake in it. And it just was, my fear was just, I'm a complete failure. I'm never going to amount to anything. I'm going nowhere. And so it's just like this little black hole that I lived in. And it's just funny what my body feels like. It's so real. There's nothing that can take me out of it. It is a happening that I just have to sit with. And I'm, you know, I can say it after the fact that I'm lucky that I know those things. But it's during that whole time, the only thing I can come to that's sort of my mantra is, this is not real. Because I just had to need one thing mm-hmm. to, like, tell my body that what it's going through is not real. But at the same time, I'm saying those words with the understanding that it's, my body thinks it's real right now, so I'm not resisting it.
I wonder if you could go a little deeper in explaining what it means when you say, I'm practicing being awake more in it, like I'm awake more in it. What does that mean?
Well, I know that when I get lost in it, I actually feel like I wake up in a few days and I look back at it and I don't remember anything. So feeling like I can describe that I was awake in it was, I felt like I remember every second of watching that wall while I just sat there and was sort of comatose in it. Mm-hmm. Comatose with my eyes open and me, my brain thinking, letting the horrible thoughts come up and then let them fall down and then a new one come up and then let it fall down. Let myself sleep instead of thinking, I need to be productive right now. I feel like shit, but I need to go do things because maybe that's going to make me feel better. It was sort of a time where I just said, nothing's going to make me feel better. I know that. So let's just do the most relaxing thing possible and stay in my house for a few days and mm-hmm. do nothing and try to communicate as succinctly as possible to those around me that rely on me in any way.
Right. Which was me, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, take the day.
Take the day. Please take the day.
And I was lucky to have a day that didn't require me to leave the house, which was great. And that's how I know. It's like I'm lucky because I was awake and being able to make those choices as opposed to just sort of just throwing the shit to the fan with everyone. And that's definitely been me in the past.
Yeah, sometimes I feel fear, and it's almost like fear shuts off parts of me that I know are there normally, but I don't have access to them.
Yep. Yeah.
And I wonder if we could, you know, question like different levels of being this word awake that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I can hear part of me thinking, well, what good is it being awake, you know, quote unquote, when I'm just staring at a wall, right? And I think, you know, the important thing that I learned is to not wait for the overwhelming parts of suffering to occur. Because when I try to tap into anything new that's not already had enough time to become part of a process or part of a ritual or part of a new habit, when those times come, it's not available to me. And I think that those moments are the moments that we are using as a gauge to sort of say whether something's working or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why medicine is, you know, become so huge, because it's following along our psychosis of today, of that we want everything to happen right now. So when we're feeling anxious, if we take a pill,
it doesn't go away.
You're pretty guaranteed that 10 minutes to a half hour, depending on what you eat, you'll feel better.
Yeah.
That's why I think that the emotions we feel, like fear, must be an invitation, because there is no rescue if you're not, you know, involved in taking medicine, which obviously, absolutely, people have to do. I've had to do. So if you don't have that, or if that's not of interest to you, the practicing when, you know Gurdjieff, the Russian philosopher, has that great way of explaining our predicament as humans, of being in prison. And even though that sounds like a bit negative, it's more meant as a metaphor. And if you could see the visual image of a prison cell.
It's a box.
Yeah. A box of what we think we're supposed to be doing, how we are going to score. That's the word I'm looking for. How we're going to score whether or not we're doing well.
Mm.
And, you know, Gurdjieff talks about how the prison is the prison of the mind. And I think that that prison of the mind could also make us be in the level of consciousness that is the mind, and yet if you are in that level of mind and you're being, as you said, awake, then you're just awake and in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going, it's taking me a while to get there, sorry.
Definitely. I was awake in the prison of it.
Right, and I'm not saying that that's not what he meant or another way to interpret it, but I can only go on that what helps me look at Gurdjieff's system with the prison and the prison of the mind, that the very first step is to know that we're in prison.
Mm-hmm.
I like the visual. I had a student draw a picture of a human skull, a person, and in right in the back was like a little window of like the skull was removed. And in the picture, you could see that what's inside is this other littler you behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say all life is hopeless then because you're stuck in prison. It's a metaphor so that we can understand that the confines of our mind, as Einstein has said, you can't look from the same mind that created that thought or that fear, you know, thoughts or fears and all of it. So in the prison of the mind, you can expand it to be that the mind is a terrible master, but a great servant. So really, I think I'm looking at what you're saying, which I can relate to completely, as if we are quote unquote awake, perhaps that sort of awake is the illusion that we are the warden at that moment, or maybe prisoner to prisoner.
Right.
Yeah, I like the stories better, because I think when we talk about stuff like this, and we're involving so many different levels of systems, like, you know, psychology and, you know, myth and spirituality, alternative sort of perceptions. When I go into a place like that, it feels to me that I think I'm awake, but I'm only awake as the prisoner, which I think is a step, obviously, because how many people are in prison and don't know it?
Right. And that to me is when I'm lost in it, I'm more in that space. When I'm awake, it's, oh, hey, there I am. Here I am, this prisoner inside the prison of my hormonal imbalanced body.
Yeah. And it's more of like a happening.
Yes.
Rather than it's happening to me.
Yes. So that's where I equate awake. Because I can see somewhat outside of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good visual. I can see that in my head.
Mm-hmm.
How many times, anybody even listening to this, has felt like, why the hell would I want to be awake?
In the pain.
In the pain. And there's many levels to the waking up to that pain. And I think definitely that's a level that you're dealing with right now. Saying, logically, I know that I'm in prison. Logically, I know that this is one of those times.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to allow this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's when asking ourselves the question, who in me is awake with this? And I think about how, as I said, the stories really help me, because I feel like we're trying to, you know, people having these kinds of dialogues are trying to talk about things that just can't be talked about in
words
that, I mean, I definitely don't have a great use of the English language by any means. Dyslexia has impaled any ability for me to do that. But boy, do I try.
Mm-hmm.
But how do I try? I try through making tons of mistakes that sometimes I don't even know they're mistakes.
No, of course not.
I don't even know. I think I'm being, you know, very proficient.
You think it's the thing that's going to help.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh, it didn't.
It didn't, yeah. And on one level, I care. And on another level, I feel like whoever's reading that or hearing that, if they're judging and it stays as them judging me, then that's their problem. And I don't mean that in a way of like, that's his problem. That's a different level. And I'm bringing this up because I think the shifts of perceptions, they should be looked at as levels. Otherwise, we look at it like, here I am staring at the wall in one of those hormonal things. I'm shifting and nothing's happening. I'm awake and nothing's appearing. But what if we could look at it as that there's many levels to that?
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what it is for every person out there. We all experience these things very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wouldn't go so be so forward to say that minimizes at all the suffering that you're going through or I'm going through while we're in it. But what it does do is it starts the journey of cultivating a new relationship to it.
Space in between.
Yeah, I think the space in between, which if you want to be really big in this concept, the space in between is when you're not having that time, you know, those 2 days a month where you're not staring at the wall. So in an average month of 30 days, the space in between is 28.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be smaller with it, maybe you wake up and you're in a great mood. So you take 5 or 10 minutes of skillful action and you do something to practice, because suffering is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the human journey. And you could suffer because you got a paper cut, or you could suffer because somebody's passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And to the person with the paper cut who's never experienced somebody passing away, that might be the greatest suffering to date that they've had. So we don't have any right to look at somebody and say, you think that's bad? You know, wait till this happens. It's all relative.
Oh, yeah.
When I think about being, you know, the prisoner in the mind, and I think, you know, the mind is this terrible master but a great slave, it allows me to understand that there is a relationship that needs to be, wants to be, can be cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
New relationship. I'm not saying that like it should be easy, but it's hard when we're all running around telling each other our sufferings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all we want to do is help each other. All we want to do is say, like, well, here's the magic, you know. I don't know of any.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any magic things that make things better. I think what does shift, and for me, I work really good with stories and imagination of when I'm depressed or when I look at a moment of feeling like you were. I imagine that that's a like a smaller but very worthy person of myself,
yeah,
within myself.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like the brain and the prison and mm-hmm. the inmate in the prison. And I can feel my ego mind saying what my personality would say to somebody, perhaps when I've had enough of this and mm-hmm. I'm sick of you talking about this and I'm sick of feeling like this and I'm sick of every month this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, in essence, am making matters worse for that little, smaller self.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never helped.
No.
And in Buddhism, they call it the second arrow. So you got the first arrow, that's the fact. Here I am.
Mm-hmm.
I know what this is, but that doesn't help me whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then is the mind that wants to keep propelling us forward shoots the second arrow. And the second arrow, as if the first one wasn't bad enough,
right,
it narrates and creates the stories.
And the judgments about it.
I'll never be okay. Mm-hmm. I'll never get out of this. I'm a loser. I'm this, I'm that.
It's like adding the huger layers of suffering on top of the suffering.
Yeah, and it's funny when we think of ourselves as being very logical people. How is that logical? It's not, right? I mean, that doesn't help at all, but it just helps to create some doubt.
Mm-hmm. Drama.
Yeah, like, it starts to doubt the mind. Not from, like, oh, I don't trust you at all. That's not going to help. But doubting, like, is it possible that everything I think has varying degrees of untruths? Is it possible that you and I, who could see the color red as two different shades, that that lies within us as well?
Mm-hmm.
Parts of Katrina can see red in one shade. Parts of Katrina can see a shade is another way. Everything isn't so black and white, especially, you know, in neuroscience.
Yeah.
And there are many people that don't even like that prison example because it makes them feel like, well, my life is great. I don't look at my life as a prison. That's a horrible way to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a way to look at the moments of our lives when we are suffering. Now, I'm not saying grieving. Grieving's a part of the experience of being human. But the stories are different than the fact. That's what I'm trying to highlight. That, yes, you're there and this is happening. But what's prolonging the suffering is that our minds start to become like a therapist to our thoughts. And as I said, that Einstein quote, which I love, you know, if that's the one that's awakening you, the ego mind pretending to be the therapist to the part of ourselves that is suffering, I can't imagine how that would work. Yeah. It's a conflict of interest.
Well, I was sort of surprised that I could even sort of make myself have the thought that this isn't real. And whatever that thought was prior to that. That's just, that's my thought. Like, I was like, think that thought. Yes. You know? Mm-hmm. Just say that in your brain right now. This isn't real. This isn't real.
Does that help?
Yeah.
It does?
Yeah.
It doesn't really help me. I wish it did, but.
I mean, I don't know how long it's going to help. You know how something helps for a little bit and then you have, it doesn't help anymore.
Yeah, it's like a momentary.
But it's a momentary stop of my, I'm a failure, I'm a this, I'm a that, you know, whatever my the little judgments. Right. It stops my judgments of, because when one thing goes wrong, the whole world is wrong. And that was where I was at. But this isn't real is more of, you know, maybe I think, you
well,
know.
Well, it might not be real.
You know? Well, my heart, you know, and it's, maybe it's actually even just balancing the scales. So I've got a very racing heart over here. And if I just kind of sat there and I'm like, my heart's racing because I'm feeling the fear in my body in different ways. And I say, this isn't real. It's, I just feels like a little trick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah, I know that.
But that just talking about that right now brought me to when we went to Six Flags a couple weeks back. We went to the top of this, they take you, it's like Tower of Doom, or I don't know, you go all the way to the top, and it's a free fall. And I had that moment of, wow, what if it's just let's go, and I'm just choosing to, like, let myself catapult to the ground and die right now. Because I have a very morbid, everything's morbid.
Yeah.
And I just, my trick was, this isn't real. You know, so, okay, that happens, great. It's like an acceptance of, so my mind's thinking the worst. It, sort of when I have a moment of accepting the fact that the worst might happen, it stops the incessant dialogue about it. It's almost like
the
dialogue's trying to keep going and going, but when I say this isn't real, my mind can't say anything else to that.
Right.
There's nothing else that comes out of that.
And that's really a great tool, then.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
My little tool.
Right.
For 2 days. Just to stop my brain from talking.
Did you go on that ride while you were in these 2 days?
No.
Okay. That would be really wild.
Yeah.
That would be.
No. But it was funny what the kind of fear that gets brought up. That was more of, wow, I am definitely 30. I'm not 15 on a roller coaster anymore. Like, the change of growing up to... Why was I choosing to be on roller coasters? Why? Because we went on 8 that night, and after the first one, I was, I'm good, I'm done, okay, had it. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this?
I don't think it's a prerequisite to that it's an age thing. I think I look at it more now as like however long you've been alive is how long you have most likely been zippering up your spacesuit. You're right, what's right, what's wrong. If, you know, a ride gave you a lot of nausea when you were 15. And then you started saying, you know, these rides get me nauseous, and that went to motion gets me nauseous, motion gets me nauseous only if I'm a passenger in the back seat, to wow, doesn't that work really good, because normally people want to sit in the front seat, so then you have all these other agendas. So maybe however old you are is just how many
more beliefs you have.
Yeah.
About everything.
Yeah, and see how myopic the thought is, yeah, that we're mostly running around saying it's because I'm older now.
Yeah.
But it's right. not because we're so older linear. Now. Yeah. Yeah, it's because we just have uninvestigated beliefs.
Yeah.
Dan Siegel, you know, scientist, he says that every 4 seconds, our brain scans and says, am I safe? Do you like me? Am I okay? So, like, in conversation with people, every 4 seconds, I'm sure he doesn't mean, he's obviously not tested everybody, but... But if that's the state of the dialogue going on, even when we're assumed to be safe and not in a fearful situation, then that means that there's part of us that is always tapped into that reptilian, that old part of our brain that is making sure that we're okay. And the belief is that other people can give that answer to us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So is that reptilian part, is that the amygdala? Is that from just doing a little bit of research about where fear sits in our brains?
That's the limbic system.
Oh, okay.
And that is, it's so interesting about the amygdala, because it really does help me. I suffered with panic attacks for years. Like, actually, not for years. It was about 2.5 years, and it was at the strangest point in my life, and I walked around saying I have panic attacks, and nothing would help. I couldn't even, I had a rubber band around my wrist and I would tap it, and I think that was my way of saying what you said, which is this isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I would feel, but I also find the irony in that,
mm-hmm,
of that, like, I'm trying to get myself back into my body.
Yeah.
And by feeling that, which I guess now I'm thinking about it, is probably what cutting is about, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Feeling something other than...
Well, getting back into the body is what I mean.
Okay.
Like, I think...
Out of brain?
I don't know this cognitively, but maybe the panic attacks I was having was... It was almost an overload. It was too much coming into me.
Yeah.
And when I snapped the rubber band... It brought me, I'm here, this is my body, and that means that I wasn't feeling that way before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of getting recognition that I'm here in this body by snapping it on my wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I got very interested in neuroscience and understanding that this is part of the human brain, because it, when you feel fear, right, and when you feel the emotions that you're speaking about, the number one thing across the board that we all feel is alone, and I'll say the word separate.
Mm-hmm.
That's, we all feel that.
Yeah.
Separate and alone. I don't want to debate whether or not that's real or not. Of course we are alone physically,
right?
Possibly. But if it stays that linear as to, like, well, I'm not alone, you can't see the amazing myths that also brings up, which is that when, look at the opposite, when somebody loves, if somebody has a loving heart, or if somebody is in love, all these terms that we have, you're not feeling alone and separate. But can being in love with one person, could that unity then turn into, it's only me and him, or me and her, or it's only my family, or it's only people that, like, you know, watermelon, and on Sundays, that's my crew? Because there's the part of us that is the survival part, that reptilian brain, and then mix it with the mammalian brain and then mix it again with the evolution of our cerebral cortex, the front part of our brain that is allowing us to check in on our own thoughts, like have a thought. Oh, there's Katrina saying a thought. And then I listen to me saying a thought and I can think about those things. You know, this cocktail of mind states, it's a very fine balance. I mean, I know 2%, you know, I know nothing. But what it does is it intrigues me to a point where when I know what the amygdala does and I understand that it's working in harmony with the hippocampus and other parts of the limbic system, that's where emotions, they flow through the amygdala and fear and happiness get regulated there and emotions. But it's not just this sole piece of the mind that has this job alone. It works in symphony with other things. Now, does fear come from, God, science is just blowing up now, you know? Well, not just now, but very much so in the roles of all the parts of our mind that are biochemically releasing, like a symphony, these different chemicals and cortisol and oxytocin, the feel-good hormone. I mean, realize what our brain is trying to do is something that no computer to this day could ever do. Mm-hmm. Nobody, nothing. And it happens in us autonomically. What some of it is and what science is looking at and what a lot of the studies out there are highlighting are what parts of fear and our emotions are coming from the fight or flight, the freeze response, that reptilian part of us that happened to me in San Francisco, where, you know, my cerebral cortex is saying, and many other parts of me are saying, I'll kick the shit out of you if you touch me. So that's one part of my brain saying one thing. How did they not check in with the rest of the platoon, as Hillman would say? How are they not checking in with the rest of the platoon? It's full of shit. Because then there I am, and I completely freeze with this man's arms around me for at least a minute and a half, 2 minutes. The torture, once I got away and days and weeks went on, of feeling my own disappointment in myself, I created all of that. Why? Because I thought I knew myself. And that was my first piece of suffering. So being that prison example is to say, it's a metaphor. Be interested in learning about the self and be open not to constantly be consistent. If my reaction at 10, you know, God forbid, was one way when I was mugged, you know, in my early 30s, it was a different way. Are you really ready for that kind of lack of control, that kind of embrace into the unknown? To me, the journey of looking at fear, it comes in so many different levels. And it's not like we ever know, oh, well, I'm, you know, I know that it's coming from a limbic place. The point is to not be so result-oriented and to be more curiosity-oriented, more experience-oriented. And it is possible that the person sitting there having that experience of staring at the wall and being depressed is not all of you. And it's not just possible in spirituality, it's actually possible in neuroscience. Genes and hereditary parts of us is what they're investigating. If it's not coming from reptilian part of our brain is, and it could be even still coming from there and be learned behavior. And learned behavior is this giant topic that I love.
Yeah.
Because learned behavior talks about not just the obvious. So it's not your parents sitting you down and saying, by the way, here's the lesson for today. When you're fearful, freeze. Yes. It doesn't work like that. It works by the mind is constantly searching for answers, constantly. So what it's finding is what's up for debate. Because we don't necessarily have to have a conscious thought of finding the answer. But parts of our mind says, you found the answer, stores it, and then you just repeat it. And then, you know, bring in therapeutic models, and they want to get to the quote-unquote source of your fear, source of your trauma. Which source? Where is it coming from? I know it could be really overwhelming. I can, you know, recommend just books for curiosity. It really depends on what it doesn't depend. What's important is the intention behind the research.
Mm-hmm.
If the intention is to go, I'm going to nick this brain and forget it.
Right.
The intention is to create and feed the curiosity parts of our mind for acceptance.
Yeah.
In the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Brain science is always changing. It's changed so much about, you know, mindfulness came in. It's been a principle of Buddhism forever.
Yeah.
Mindfulness is now being looked at with fMRI scans, and it's feeding us all this great information, not of what it is, but what it's like. It's such an intricate process being human.
Mm-hmm.
So just in knowing that, right, that's when the mythology and the stories help me, because I could never know enough. I could never. And when I'm sitting there and I'm depressed looking at the wall, I'm not going to be thinking about all of this. But whatever I've been cultivating, those are the times when you'll be able to pull from them. Whether it's real or not,
mm-hmm.
nobody will know.
Yep.
And think about it as when I say, like, cultivating relationship to things. I know that we want it to go away as quickly as it can. But what if it's about meeting it for the first time? And what that entails? Oh, my word. I mean, there's millions of systems I could recommend. I mean, Peter Levine, Waking the Tiger. That's just a pivotal book of somatics. The polyvagal theory, Stephen Porges, a great system to check out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to find the answers, though. It's just to feed that part of us that's curious and find what's right for you in that moment. And what if, instead of staring at the wall, try a mirror?
Yeah.
Because the things that we seek, the help that we seek, it really is in here. Because even if somebody could offer it to you, who knows if we can hold that?
Right.
What does that look like to you? Like, what ideas would that bring to you for that moment that you're offering up for us right now?
Like, what could I do if I went and looked in the mirror instead?
Yeah, like, do you feel like you could hold yourself, not physically, but like hold a space for Olivia that is allowed to have those 2 days, and your life is in a place where you can do that?
Well, if that's what I felt like I had. I was closest to that this last time around, because there was just an acceptance to it. There was, you know, my little trick of saying this is not real quieted the conversation. So that it felt sort of just like a nothingness, which felt more better than all of the...
Than a somethingness.
Than all of the something that was talking.
Yeah.
And there was an acceptance of it because it, you know, there was a bit of a heightened lead up to it, which Adam is the one who's really like given me that, oh, you're feeling really happy right now. Okay, we're probably going to witness the low. Like, oh, okay. And so I'm going, and then it's like, boom, and then drop, and then it's sort of a, okay, well, how long is this going to last now? If I'm awake, I at least have...
Well, that's not awake, though, because awake...
Yeah.
Is just say how long is it going to last, because you're looking for an end.
But what if it was, more of a curiosity of, is this going to be a week or two? Or is this going to be a day? Is this going to be an hour? Like, I'm curious. I like knowing how long they are.
But do you ever?
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what about gearing the curiosity to be more about, ooh, who's this?
Okay.
What's this?
Okay.
What does it feel like inside of yourself? Is there a physical shift? I know you well enough to know that there is.
Yeah.
But what about looking for different words to describe it? Because mm-hmm. the cerebral mind will go to the same old things. An orange is orange, round. Mm-hmm. You have to peel it. We have these great, you know, stories that our minds are able to tell of what things are like.
Mm-hmm.
What does it feel like inside that isn't the normal way to describe the right. inside of you?
Right. So coming up for new words other than
sucks.
Right. Well, I think I lose compassion. I'm completely compassionless. I care about nothing. I could make really harsh, mean decisions. I have absolutely no humor.
Yeah, I mean, that could happen to me in 5 minutes.
Yeah, but this is like that time that's like, these are the lacking mm-hmm. things. Like, whatever is going on, whatever hormone is completely depleted in my body, which would be really interesting to find out
yeah.
what's depleted from me that's taking away all of these abilities. Like, that's more what I'm curious about. Like, what is this? Like,
what if it's just a shift of consciousness? It's just one that we've been told is not great. See, like the pushing away of it, which is where I was totally, and where I could be tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
the pushing away of it stops our ability to find another mind,
mm-hmm.
let's say heart mind, in which to dialogue about it. So that's why they say just don't dialogue. But
yeah.
I mean, good luck with that.
Well, I think trying to not dialogue. So I'm in that place of, this is me learning how to accept that it exists. Maybe I can't be curious and like, oh, hey, Olivia,
yeah,
crazy Olivia.
Right.
Whatever you are, Olivia. I'm just in the, okay. I'm getting, because I've started the practice of whenever I have a very new emotion in the day or mm-hmm. those I call my down days or bad days or whatever I call them. I write them in my little calendar and I can see some patterns from them over the past mm-hmm. couple months that I've been doing it. And it looks like it's about a week prior to when I'll have, you know, the female period.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's going to last longer or whatever. So I'm liking the interest in that. I'm at least cataloging. I'm putting down notes. I'm helping myself like look at the breadcrumbs back
mm-hmm.
to have some sort of inkling into preparation, maybe, if I can't even be there yet. So I'm in curiosity, I know. Like, not every day I'm not that great curious about it, but I'm in curiosity about it. And the cataloging of it on my calendar has been probably the biggest step
mm-hmm.
that I've been feeling.
Taking an action of some sort.
Something.
That's different.
Yeah. Because it felt like I would completely forget that this would ever happen to me, and so it was the craziest thing that was ever happening in the world.
Fantastic
and
mind.
Someone goes, this happens to you all the time, and I'm like, what? No, it doesn't. This does not happen. This is brand new. Something huge is happening,
mm-hmm.
and I need help. Happens to you all the time, Olivia. What?
Wow.
At least I'm not there. Could be.
Isn't that an amazing shift of perception?
Yeah.
So you think we should all be asking each other, hey, do you happen to notice, like, do I always do this? Somebody yesterday said to me, Oh, I used to crack my toes, and I went, that's a really random, weird thing to say to me. What the hell? Why did you just say that out of nowhere? She's like, you just cracked your toes. I'm like, no, I didn't.
So you were doing something unconsciously.
Completely. Right? And almost in that prison of my own mind, if I didn't witness it, it didn't happen.
Absolutely did not.
Yeah.
Oh.
But I feel the you know, that's something little, of course, not to compare that to horrible it feels to feel pain and suffering. And, man, I just want to be really clear, too, that I'm not one of those people that thinks that, I hope this doesn't sound hopeless, but I don't think fears go away. They may, but it just becomes less the point. Because fear is present, right? And look at changing the dialogue from my fear to the fear. Because my fear separates you. You're alone. It's that whole story again. The fear. It's the fear. I mean, some of the greatest teachers I've ever practiced with and from and meet today. Did you just hear that?
Yeah.
I just cracked my toes.
Oh, cool.
Didn't even know it. But I got closer because halfway through the cracking, I saw it. So what, Katrina? I have no idea why. But what was I saying?
Fear's not going away. Fear's...
Some of the greatest teachers, yeah. They can see all their fears and personality flaws and shortcomings as you walk along the road, almost like those footprints in the sand. They're still there. It's just that the relationship to them has changed. So I don't want anybody, especially my own psyche, who obviously I'm always talking to when I'm talking out loud, to stop looking for them to go away. I'm not saying welcome them and be like, hey, come in. If you're there, then great. You're way further than I am. But if you're still in the place of like, how long is this going to last? Or why did bad things keep happening to me? Or why am I so scared of this or that? There is this acceptance that is a result of meeting them. But I think if you put the word acceptance before you meet them, that also might feel like laziness. Mm-hmm. It might feel like separation from, I'm just in a place of acceptance. Like, that's it. I'm just accepting I'm not making my bed every day. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's, you know, right, good or bad for you. It's neither. It's just either you're making the bed or you're not. Mm-hmm. But notice how separate we all feel when we get stuck in a repetitive thought. And is there any room for the possibility that all you're doing is shifting a perception and we've all labeled it fear and fear is labeled as horrible?
Right.
What if it's just wide open? And it's a different perception, and it's meant for us to investigate it and to create new definitions, new what's serving and what's not. I mean, it's going to be there either way, right? Mm-hmm. So you still have this fear, say, of a roller coaster. Say somebody has a fear of a roller coaster. You're not going to go on it. You're just going to push away roller coasters the rest of your life. What does that roller coaster represent? Not in like I got to go back in my memory and remember my father took me on a roller coaster. It can go there, but it doesn't have to. It could just be, I've narrowed it down to, I still think I'm in control of a hell of a lot that I'm actually not.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at neuroscience, it helps us come to a place of acceptance that it's impossible to know at all times what the symphony of our mind and our body is creating without us even knowing it. You're sitting here alive, breathing, and your heart's beating. You have nothing to do with that.
Yep.
So it's possible that it's not even a deficiency, you know, because that word feels like I'm without.
Yeah.
But that it's just a shift from what we have deemed as normal.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, because I feel like it came to me that I have to look at this time as a gift.
Yeah, I don't want to be so far as to ever give somebody those words, but you said
it. You know what I mean? Yeah. These are words for me.
Yep.
Just like I have my little trick with this isn't real, and that's working for now, great, during that time, whatever. Instead of this is a really horrible time, look at this gift I've been given.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's
least
taking away the negative connotation of the words I would use for it.
Just investigate the negative, you know, what shifts in you when it's not associated right away with a negative.
Yeah. Right.
Like, because negative is present in our world, so it's there. It's there in abundance. We don't want to push that away. You can't live the whole life never seeing a roller coaster again. And the psyche knows that. And so if we're scared of the roller coaster, we get down to, you know, what it could be. And then you can channel that to investigate further from a healthier place, right?
Yeah.
And like, I think where spirituality can go with this is looking at the models of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And if there in a perfect world, we'd all love to be able to be unattached, you know, meaning that we're not clinging to everything, to having to be the exact way we want it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not in that perfect world, nor would I want to be. I would be so disinterested in like a human existence without that.
Mm-hmm.
But if attachment is present, is there another shift where we could be in healthy attachment?
Yeah.
You know? So like attachment, I heard this a scientist talking about how we develop fears audibly too.
Mm-hmm.
And the olfactory system and the smell and visual, and they all get processed different in our brains. So when a child grows up, what men, you know, fathers tend to do when they get mad is they get lower and deeper. And what mothers tend to do is they get like, why don't we just clean your room?
Mm-hmm. And so they were talking about doing all these fMRI studies and that our brain processes it very much like a regular computer would, where it gets an icon on our desktop of our mind and it says high sounds, out of nowhere, fear. Mm-hmm.
Low sounds, out of nowhere, at this volume, fear.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not consciously aware of that. And I say that in an effort to say, don't try to think you're going to go down this journey of discovering every single trigger. What it's really about is saying, like, I know nothing.
And that's how I'll at least take in
a
lot more.
Yeah, because otherwise acceptance is just like a Band-Aid. You can't just...
Well, I accept it.
I accept it. Yeah.
I'm done.
And
I accepted it.
Yeah, and that did nothing for me. Like, I can accept lots of stuff, but I'm not really accepting it. I just think I'm accepting it.
Yeah.
Hafiz said, fear is the cheapest room in the house, and I would like to see you in better living conditions. I love that one for myself.
Yes, it's so good.
Yeah, and there's this other article, I'll put this all up on the blog, called Decoding the Neuroscience of Fear and Fearlessness. I before I say that, I encourage everybody to look at how many different levels you can look at emotions from, like neuroscience understandings and neuroscientific understandings, psychological views on it, from even just like attachment theory. And you know, you can have the biological view of what's going on, and you can also look at the spiritual view of living life without there being this constant need for a result. Because if you notice that most of the times that we're suffering, it's because the result either wasn't what we wanted, or it hasn't come quick enough, or it came too quick. Somebody the other day said to me, I got, you know, moved to this other office. And I said, well, that's great. You told me that that's a couple of months ago you wanted to go. Well, this is too soon. I wasn't expecting it this soon. And we're always walking around shocked.
Yeah.
I can't even begin to tell you how many fears I walk around with. If I didn't have those fears, Olivia, I don't think I would be teaching. Mm-hmm. You know? Teaching and forget even teaching, just sharing and
right.
being around people with an intention to just be
mm-hmm.
and to create. Is that's the practice. I'm looking at those models of like, what do I normally do, and just do something different, like you're gonna do.
Yeah.
Anyway, this article, Decoding the Neuroscience of Fear and Fearlessness, has a picture of a cartoon picture of a giant alligator with his mouth open, and a person walking into the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Not walking out. And I love that because it makes me think of that we're inviting our demons in for tea.
Yeah.
We're inviting them in and sitting around inside the cave, inside that prison. All right, everybody, come around, sit around the fire. All right, here you are. Fear of roller coaster or fear of this. Now you've got the platform. Talk. Say what you're going to say. Mm-hmm. And for me, it helps when I write it down.
Yeah.
Because another part of me will translate it completely different later.
Yeah.
Oh, this fear said that. That this worry said that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cartoon's great because he's walking into it. He's walking into it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of holding the mouth open with both of his hands, like, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm going to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of walking away, or instead of not even getting in the mouth and waiting for the crocodile to appear. I mean, most of my stress is waiting for the crocodile to appear, the alligator to appear.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mind tells me it can.
Mm-hmm.
And it may never, ever come. But the mind is convinced that the more you think about it, the more prepared you'll be.
Yeah.
And just question how that has actually worked for you in the past. So you can check out, I have some recommendations. I like Diane Poole Heller. She's a PhD. She's got some lectures online. And she does some really good work in attachment and understanding it from that place. As I said, Stephen Porges, the polyvagal theory, is an interesting approach. There's a book. I think I have it. Right here, Memory, Brain and Body in Search for the Living Past. And that is by Peter Levine, the guy who does Waking the Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives you, not in this book, but in Waking the Tiger, actual practices, like little meditations and ways you can walk yourself through maybe a more clinical, because you're reading it, way of seeing them and facing them and seeing what comes up, and that somatic approach of going inside the body, because the body has all these answers. You know, part of what one of them had said was that fears can only be memory. They could only be memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a memory of either something you witnessed or something you thought about. But right here and now, if the more we're here in the now, the more we're practicing being here in the now, it's not to say that fear doesn't occur, but the new relationships comes from being with what is right here, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to think of yourself as a logical person, I would love to hear how your preparation for some fearful event has worked for you more than two or three or four times.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the one time it works, you could see how we go, see, if I didn't,
mm-hmm.
if I wasn't worried about it, I never would have made the left instead of the right. But I mean, listen, this is like a whole placebo effect here.
Yeah.
With those kind of statistics, you would never align yourself with just that. Anyway, there's lots of stuff here. Krishnamurti, a great teacher, he says, it is not that you must be free from fear. The moment you try to free yourself from fear, you create a resistance against fear. Resistance in any form does not end fear. What is needed rather than running away or controlling or suppressing or any other resistance, is understanding fear. That means watch it, learn it, learn about it, come directly into contact with it. We are to learn about fear, not to escape from it, not how to resist it through courage and so on. I love that. Didn't you have some?
Yeah, that one made me think of, if I get the name wrong, but where fear is, happiness is not. Lucius Annaeus Seneca. I'm going to have to research that.
Can you just read that again?
Where fear is, happiness is not.
Interesting.
It's succinct. And I feel like there's more in that. Like that mm-hmm. little sentence itself, someone can explore mm-hmm. to really, it's like, is that really true? Is that really mm-hmm. true? Because...
I'd be curious for that.
Yeah. Because it makes me want to be like, well, let me find the happiness in my fear.
that sounds great, Liv.
one I really liked, and it's probably one I'm going to put up because I absolutely want to do this when I feel this way. Don't let the fear of what could happen make nothing happen.
Oh, that's so good.
And there was no author to that. That was just question marks, so I might have
that's
to research.
That's so good, too.
Oh, gosh. Jack Canfield mm-hmm. said, "Everything you want is on the other side of fear."
Wow, thanks, Jack.
So get through your fear now. Come on, guys.
Why are we preloaded?
I am. When thinking about this, I was talking to my best friend, Amanda. Whenever I really don't want to do something, a part that I really don't want to get as far as, being an actress, I just go into those auditions, and somehow I get those, I get those roles. It's like, oh, man.
No leaning, no attachment.
Yes, and I've totally been tricking myself when I go in to really just not want these things. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I find when I really dislike something and I do it, I get the most growth out of it, or I get something deeper out of it because I really didn't want to do it, but then I did it. And then it's like this huge sigh of relief, like, wow, I'm really glad I did that. So Mark Twain says, "Do the thing you fear most and the death of fear is certain."
That's going right into the fire.
Mm-hmm. So those were a couple of my favorites.
I mean, what if we start small?
Really small, yeah.
You know, like the likes and dislikes list?
Like, I really didn't want to drive your car around to do your errands the other day.
Exactly. Yeah, and you did it.
But I did.
Yeah. Yeah, start small, right?
The whole time I had to really not obsess about what if I get in a car wreck right now mm-hmm. and... someone gets in a car wreck with me in your car.
And what happens? What's the story?
I just had to stop those things. I don't even know what my technique was. So I just sort of make my mind go black and
But what if you follow the thought, though? So what happens? You cracked my car. It was your fault. What happens?
Well, right now I'm not as emotionally invested in it, but then... the police come and maybe insurance doesn't cover it because your insurance doesn't cover other drivers. Mm-hmm. My insurance doesn't cover me unless I'm in my car. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, did someone else get hurt in it? Mm-hmm. Am I going to suffer the rest of my life with having hurt someone else? Mm-hmm. Hurt your car. All my fault.
All my fault.
But actually, it's not been your fault because you told me to go in the car.
There you go, right? And then you can avoid entirely facing the fear altogether. It's just not... It's the funny thing is it's not your fault and it's not my fault. It just is. Yeah. But what you just did is going into the prison and you looked at the furniture mm-hmm. and the way that the cell is decorated.
Yeah.
That's what you did. And then you just try to... Not like, yeah, all you got to do is... You just go in and you say, you know what? I kind of had it with that love seat. I'm going to move it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to either try to something else and not move anything else in.
Yeah.
So I can be free rather than just momentarily happy, which will move slowly into momentarily pissed off. Because yeah. that's just the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
I like that last quote. Mm-hmm. Into the fire. Keep your heart open in hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's the work, right?
Yeah.
I'll read last one. It's by Rumi. I mean, honestly, I could read just the first line and it would be enough, but I wouldn't bastardize his words. He just says, forget safety. He goes on to say, live where you fear to live. Live where you fear to live. But, you know, don't be so linear, metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
Don't. It doesn't mean you have to move to, you know, Alaska and you hate cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
Where does your beliefs live?
Yeah.
Destroy your reputation. Be notorious.
Yeah.
So you forget safety. Live where you fear to live. Go where you could never imagine. You have a fear of paperclips, use paperclips. You love peanut butter, try not eating peanut butter for a month. What appears? Mm-hmm. Not because you want to get off peanut butter and you're pushing away peanut butter. And be willing and curious of what it's like to destroy your reputation, because your reputation is built on all the stories of who you think you are. Yeah. And it might not even be accurate. You mm-hmm. think your reputation's one way, and then ask yeah. five other people, bet you'll get five other stories.
Yeah.
So being willing to ruin your reputation is dropping all your beliefs. Obviously, not altogether.
Yeah.
But being willing to go, I'm going to go more for meeting truth moment to moment. I think it was Gandhi that said that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Dalai Lama, I can't remember. Be willing to meet truth moment to moment and in my words, forget about consistency.
Yeah.
Every time you say to somebody else, well, this is what you normally do. I just expected that.
Mm-hmm.
We have the visual that you are pushing them into the prison cell.
Yeah.
Deeper and further in. That's not your problem. That's their problem. But if you love this person, you don't want to keep pushing them in prison.
Mm-hmm.
The prison of the mind.
Yeah.
And if you love yourself, you don't, the more you push somebody else in prison, the more it indicates how much you're pushing yourself into your prison.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a great one?
Yeah.
I love it.
Me too.
Thanks, Olivia.
Thanks, Katrina.
this just doesn't even cover. Fear should be its own freaking
Series.
We all have fears, every single one of us. If we think less about getting rid of the fears as an indication of how spiritual you are, you might be able to actually invite one in, maybe this lifetime, maybe 10, maybe this lifetime. But it truly is not about living a life in this constant state of fearlessness if you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
Just be with who you are and know that me and Olivia are sitting here being with our shitty ass selves every day. Interesting how you did this. Interesting how you did that.
Yeah.
And it's all a process. It's all a process of learning. And when we give up that, there has to be some indication of how far we've gotten,
mm-hmm.
then the real practice starts.
Mm-hmm.
And we all need reminders for that. That's what these podcasts are for, you know,
yeah.
for you and me and anybody listening to just say, you know, stop judging.
Yep.
Stop judging.
Stop it.
Stop it. What was it, Bob Newhart? Go on Google, go on YouTube, and humor helps take out, it knocks out some of your default system, by the way, your default reaction system. And you'll notice that if you're in a shitty mood and you listen to some comedy, something that really makes you laugh, it can change you.
Mm-hmm.
Snap, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Google Bob Newhart. He's an old comedian. He's passed away now, I think. Watch, I start this whole craze. Bob Newhart's dead.
No, he's not.
No, he's not. He's in Fresno having a chai latte.
But he dies tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. And that would be Ral. If I didn't say that, Bob wouldn't have died. Wrong. Wrong. It has nothing to do with me. I do not have that kind of power, and neither do you. Bob Newhart, it's called Stop It. It's amazing. And it's a great way to look at this from a sense of humor. So we all shouldn't take ourselves so seriously.
Got that right, Katrina.
So where can they find us, Liv?
Find us at functionalyogaonline.com. You can find us on Instagram at functionalyogaonline. Facebook.com/functionalyoga.
She's doing a little dance right now. She's like... She's like
stretching
tutu
my
on. Yeah. And she's like in her tutu doing like a little, I am the social media announcer.
But we're all over the place, guys. So come join in all this fun.
And I'll post the anatomy of fear. It's a diagram. Just interesting place to sort of start to look at what happens in our body when we get into the place of fear. What messages we're sending to ourselves. And you know what? Just have the thought that maybe the fear isn't even yours. Maybe it's not mine. Maybe it's learned behavior that we can just approach from a different angle. So thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.